Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to give photography such extraordinary and enduring power, and how is that power harnessed to connect us to places we've never been and people we have never met? National Geographic magazine this year celebrates its 125th anniversary. In that time, it has sent photojournalists to seemingly every corner of every continent to capture images of wildlife, landscapes, and the endless variety of human existence. Sarah Lean joins us to talk about carrying on that long tradition. She is the current director of photography at National Geographic, which has just published a special 125th anniversary edition called The Photography Issue that's on newsstands now. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So this issue sounds like an amazing idea and an incredibly daunting one at the same time. Can you talk about the sort of framing concept that you applied to guide what you would put into it?
Well, it was truly a labor of love for all of us who worked on that issue. When we were thinking about, you know, how to celebrate our 125th anniversary in the magazine, we thought one of our great strengths and beauties is our photography, and let's use this issue to really put photography out there front and center, sort of in a different way, and also really celebrate the photographers who take these pictures. So we started thinking about how powerful photography is to witness incredible events, to celebrate beauty, to prove facts, to show, help us relate to people and other cultures. So we use that sort of framework of the power of photography to build the issue.
And there are some historic photos here, including the Afghan girl on the cover, which remains probably the most recognized photograph that the magazine has ever published.
Yes.
Mostly, though, this is new work.
A lot of new work. We're definitely, referencing, like you say, like the Afghan girl, and the cover kind of folds out with a lot of classic photographs. But we chose six stories, six photographers, and six bodies of work to publish that is newer work. Although some of the photographers have been working on those subjects for a number of years and are really dedicated to those particular topics or landscapes or creatures. So we decided to build on that, and we sent them all back to do more work on these projects so that we could really expand that voice. So there's a lot of new work. We even have an essay in the magazine all about sort of the digital frontier, everything from Instagram to photographer artists who are using a Google Street to create new imagery.
How did the advent of something like the iPad version of National Geographic, or I should say the tablet version, how has that changed the way everybody from the editorial staff to the photographers who are, I should say the editing staff to the photographers out in the field, changed what they're looking for and the potential of how they can use those images?
In 2010, we started our tablet edition of the magazine, and at first it was just kind of transferring it. It was like more of a transfer process, and then we were able to add some interactive elements. And now it's a lot more multimedia involved, a lot more audio, interviews, interactives. I think that all of us now, we don't start a story even without thinking, what are we going to do in terms of multimedia? A lot of the photographers are now doing their own video and capturing sound, and they're very keen on it. They really enjoy doing it. You know, it's just another way to tell the story and another way we can engage people in the topics. So it's really become definitely from the beginning of every story, we're thinking about adding those elements to the features. So, and it's fun. It's like something that when we do a big projections at the close of every photo coverage, and always at the end we have these little multimedia bits that are sort of rough cuts of things, and it's really a part of the process we all look forward to seeing.
Sarah, was everybody eager to embrace those innovations initially, or was there some hesitation, some concern that maybe the value of simply beautifully produced still images would be diminished by those?
Well, I think, it's sort of like when there, people were out there and they were photographing with like these large sort of speed graphic cameras, that were very big and clunky, and they just even went to 35 millimeter smaller cameras, they kind of thought that was the end of the world. So every step toward technology, people have some fears because it's a change and they don't know. I think even moving from film to digital, there was there's some little bit of a reluctance. But once people see what these new things can do, I don't think anything really goes away. Mm-hmm. I think you just keep adding. It's all additive to me. We still have photographers here who do film, who shoot like large format film or medium format film and who really love film. And, I grew up with film and shooting film myself, so I love the quality that film has, but I also understand how great digital is or video is. So I just feel like we continually add tools to our toolkit to help us tell our stories.
So we've been fortunate enough to have a number of photojournalists from National Geographic on the show before. They are always very interesting. I've wondered if when you are hiring for these very rare open positions, if you're looking for not simply the ability to tell a really amazing story with images, but is there a certain kind of personality that you're looking for?
Well, it takes all kinds, mm-hmm. In every walk of life. It's a combination of like a fabulous image maker who has really a beautiful eye and can make compelling photographs that make you care. But also our photographers, in most cases, are pretty good journalists, good reporters. We don't really say, here's, a story, go here, take this, that, and the other thing. We say, we're going to do a story about this, let's develop it, you bring stuff in, they go on the ground, they find things, they report them, they bring them back. They're totally involved in the whole development of the story. So you have to be a pretty good journalist to be able to do that. There are other very special skills. There are some of our photographers who are, underwater, so they have to have the kind of skills to be able to shoot amazing images underwater, which, how they do that, I have no idea. It's just a mystery to me how you can do that. It was hard enough doing it on the ground, breathing air. Then the mountain climbers, there's very special skill sets that we have to look for. I think personality-wise, it depends on the story. Like if somebody is photographing animals all the time, they may not have to be the kind of person that needs to be very good with people, mm-hmm. right? But the people photographers, are the ones that are very sensitive and good listeners and know how to interact with people and gain their trust.
Talk a little bit about your own background and how you came to National Geographic.
Well, I've more than once I've said I feel like I was born, in a closet down the hallway because I feel like I've been here so long. Because I interned here mm-hmm. When I was in college. I won a contest called the College Photographer of the Year, and the prize was a photographic internship here, as it still is to this day. And so that was my first step in the door. And then years later, I started freelancing as a photographer and spent about 20 so years doing stories all over the place, especially like sort of the Arctic areas like Siberia and Alaska. And then I became a photo editor about 8 years ago, and just this past year was promoted to director of photography. Pretty much a dream job.
Yeah, I suppose that's got to be the pinnacle, right? That's what you've been working toward all this time.
Well, I never necessarily thought that's what I was working toward, mm-hmm. but I think it's sort of like, sort of that idea of, you follow your bliss. And mm-hmm. and also sort of what you're good at. And it was just kind of like this evolution where I discovered as I went along the way, that not only did I enjoy taking the pictures, but I loved looking at other people's pictures and and working with photographers sort of in a teaching aspect, first with like workshops and, you know, just shaping a coverage and looking at a set of images. So I got really engaged in that part of photography. Mm-hmm. So it's so great now, you know, I get to work with all these amazing photographers and look at their work and try to help them, you know, build their stories and get them in the pages. You know, we want everyone to succeed, so it's really a pleasure.
Okay, so according to the magazine, last year, 2012, your photographers made about 2 million photographs on assignment for National Geographic.
And somebody looked at all of them.
Really? So it's not a matter of they bring you their best 100 and then you call those down to a dozen?
No, they have to kind of, and it's, I think it's fairly unusual, but the photographers, if you're on assignment for us, you have to turn every frame in, like, and no deleting while you're out there, right? It's like you have to turn it all in, and the photo editor who's assigned to that project, they will look at every single picture. We do appreciate them giving us an edit, but we're still going to look at everything. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of part of our process, sort of ground-truthing everything. Also, you see so much when you are looking at a photographer's entire take. Mm-hmm. You really see how they see. You know,
Yeah. See
how they are moving their body, you know, how they're going in and going out or climbing up the tree or something, so that when you're in conversation with them about it, you can talk about those things like, hey, you know, you need to climb that tree more often, mm-hmm. or this is fantastic. I love how you're doing this, you know, and so I think it's a wonderful part of the process that we've kind of hung on to.
So somebody's looking at every photograph. What does it take to cull through those and pick 1,500 that actually make the print issue?
Well, we have every story is assigned to a story team, and on that team will be one of our 10 photo editors, and that person will work with the photographer very, very closely, and they will be the ones who look at all those pictures, and they will go through, and they'll look, and you'll cull through, and you'll maybe take 20,000 images first down to 2,000, and then you'll take it down to 200, and then you just keep squishing it down, right? And you're editing with the story in mind all the time, like, well, what's the story? What's important? You know, if it's a story about, Afghanistan, or like, let's say the Afghan girl, you know, the story that she was in, you know, the refugee situation, that's something we need to have pictures from this place, from that place, what the themes are. So you're always thinking about that, and we go through series of edits. We also have like a meeting halfway through the story where we do sort of a projection with the editor, Chris Johns. We show him the work. We kind of course correct or say we need more of this, less of that, and then we do that again at the end of the assignment. So there's a lot that goes into making one of our stories.
How much lobbying do the individual photographers do with regard to placement? Because in many issues, including this one, there are extraordinary photographs that, because of sort of the physical properties of a magazine, are bifurcated by the seam down the middle.
Oh, yeah. The gutter, we call it.
Uh-huh.
The dreaded gutter.
Right.
Yes. Well, in that editing process I was talking to you about where we look at everything, we do a lot of that with the photographers. We used to bring the photographer in, so sort of for some of the, not starting at 20,000 pictures, but later, like starting at 200. Now we still bring photographers in, but we also do it sort of virtually by mm-hmm. screen sharing through any number of like Skype type programs,
yeah.
where we're on, you know, headphones and we're editing together. So the photographers, and this is always something that's been so special about this place, and as a photographer myself working here was special, was the involvement that you have from the very beginning, from concept through editing straight into layout. And as terms of the lobbying, yes, the photographers always have their favorite pictures.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break, but we'll finish this in a moment. My guest is Sarah Lean, Director of Photography at National Geographic. The 125th anniversary edition of the magazine is out now. It's called The Photography Issue. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Geographic's Director of Photography, Sarah Lean. The 125th anniversary edition of the magazine is out on newsstands now. It is called The Photography Issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Sarah, you were telling us the photographers do indeed lobby for their favorite shot.
Yes, it's they always have their favorite pictures, and sometimes their favorite picture has to do with, you know, the backstory of, but I climbed that mountain, and I risked my life, and I had to stand at the edge of some precipice. And we're like, well, I understand that, but this other picture might be better, mm-hmm. or tell the story better. So we do have a lot of that dialogue. It's often fun, and sometimes you can kind of get stuck in a place, and I'll go grab another photo editor and do what I call like a readership survey, you know, and bring somebody else in to say, which one of these do you like better? So it's a constant evolution.
How much of your annual budget is about insuring these men and women who are standing on the edge of a mountain?
I don't know the answer to that. That's an interesting question. You know, most of all of our photographers, most of them carry their own insurance, mm-hmm. but we do have a program that we invest in for them. It's called MedX, and it's like a medical emergency service that we, so if something would happen to someone, we can just kind of hit that button and helicopters can go get them, or we can do whatever it takes to get them out. We definitely have their backs when they're out there. We try to give them all the support we can. We have protocols that we set up if we have photographers going into dangerous situations. In this issue, we have a story about conflict mineral mining in the Congo.
Yeah.
The photographer, Marcus Leesdale, he spent many years there, but even so, at one point, he and his picture were arrested, and we had a whole protocol right in place with the U.S. Embassy to get them out as quickly as possible.
So no matter how experienced, everybody has like a first time they cover a conflict zone or go into a particular region that they might be covering. Can you talk a little bit about the preparation for someone who is going into what might be a dangerous place for the first time?
Well, I think if somebody has chosen to do that, you would hope that they would talk to other people who have done it before.
Yeah.
When I was here working as an intern, the director of photography at the time, Robert Gilka, who just passed away this past year, he sent me to work on a story in Uganda, in Africa, and Uganda had just had a total change in government, and it was still pretty dicey over there, and like I hadn't been anywhere. And I totally ran around, and I talked to everybody, you know, and what do you bring? What do you take? What do you do? What shouldn't you do? The other thing is if you're going somewhere in a conflict zone where there's other photographers working, like if you're covering something that's more, a little more newsy, then often other photographers are there too. And it's really important, I think, to hook up with the people who have experience and spend time with them, shadow them. A lot of photographers do things where they go in groups. That's really smart if it's that type of a story. So I think there's things you can do. Mm-hmm. It just takes a particular personality of somebody who's willing to take those types of risks.
We have an email here from Allison in Dallas who wants to know how you feel about Instagram.
I love Instagram. Hmm. I have my own feed. It's how I take most of my pictures these days.
Really?
I know. Yeah, I love my cell phone camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so convenient. And we have a fantastic Instagram feed called @NatGeo that our photographers post while they're out on assignment or anytime they want to that feed. And it has about, I think it's one of the largest feeds. It's about 2.5 million followers. So I think Instagram is like fun. It's a great way to share pictures. It's a great way to be. It's kind of this wonderful photo conversation, depending on how, who you follow and how you use it. I think it's really, really a wonderful tool, and it's amazing how popular it's gotten. Mm-hmm. I think these communities. I mean, we've got one that we're starting. We've started and we're really launching this month also, called Your Shot, where people can upload their photos to our digital community and be more. It's a bit more like being in conversation with each other, as well as editors and photographers. And this month we have a whole push going on for that, and there's like prizes and assignments and all kinds of stuff. I think I love all that stuff.
Yeah, it is interesting when you make it feel like a collaborative process, even though the vast majority of us will never take a photograph that would, you know, even qualify to be on your desk at the $2 million a year level. it does sort of feel like we're part of what National Geographic is trying to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're so much about storytelling and exploration, discovery, and going out there and sharing what we see and find and report with everybody. But I think there's totally, like, places for things that are, like, fun and entertainment, beauty, serendipity. In this also in this issue at the front, we have a section called Photo Journal, which is little things, like smaller things. And there's a wonderful photo journal this month by Theron Humphrey, who photographs his dog Maddie. He's gotten a lot of publicity where he sets her up on different things and photographs her, and they're the most charming pictures. You know, if you love dogs, you have to see this.
So, right. Sarah, clearly you are open to technology and tools and innovation.
I'm eclectic.
What about Photoshop and sort of digital manipulation? Is that okay if it's made clear to readers that
well,
that's what it is?
You know, that's, it's like, we're not so keen on Photoshop, mm-hmm. you know. We don't want to, it's, Photoshop is, it's sort of like, okay, if you go in the dark room and you're printing a picture, and you're doing, you know, you need some contrast, you need to do something a little bit with the colors, you know, that kind of thing. It's like when Photoshop's used as like a printing tool, mm-hmm. that's fine for us, mm-hmm. right? We're printing it, we're making it look good, but we're not changing the blue sky to purple. We're not adding cows in the road that weren't there.
Right.
You know, that's no good. That's not us. That's mm-hmm. not journalism. So we're very strict about abiding by that sort of the journalistic ethic of just reporting the world. But it's like, I think Photoshop for us is more like a tool. When we do things like, let's say, create a panorama image out of several images, like you're stitching together images, we usually say so.
Yeah.
I think it's very important, like if you are doing any kind of manipulation, at least in our magazine, if we're going to do something and make more of an illustrated picture, we're going to call it that and we're going to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Is there in your mind a perfect balance between sort of grand sweeping landscape sorts of shots and things that show numerous people within a society somewhere, and then close-ups? Does that just happen organically when that mix exists within a particular issue?
You mean an issue or within a particular story?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, let's say within a story.
Well, you know, it depends on the piece and what it needs. Like, I'm thinking of a piece we did a few years ago, photographer Jim Richardson, who was doing landscapes in Scotland of the Hebrides, right? Mm-hmm. And they were sweepers. I mean, they were epic, gorgeous, big things. And every once in a while, you know, he would come in close on a little pool with starfish or something in it, you know? And I think that's all about building the pacing within the story,
yeah.
You know? Some stories are completely little close-ups. There's a photographer, David Litchwager, who that works with us a lot, who's very much into the macro world, you know, and he photographs a lot of little things and makes these wonderful sort of collages that show all the creatures that he found in, like, one story he did on one cubic foot, you know, everything that was in that cubic foot of water or prairie or something. So it's all, you know, it's all about, like, getting the feel right within the story. And then within the issue, like this October issue, you know, we have journalism. We have Abelardo Morel's amazing camera obscura landscapes of parks. We have North Korea. We have animals. You know, we have animal portraits. So within the issue, you know, we have a variety of topics and styles.
I'll tell you what I really like that I wasn't expecting is you have a piece called The Changing Face of America, which is a bunch of really intimate portraits of people with very brief explanations of how they identify racially and ethnically.
Yes. Martin Scholler, who's an amazing portrait photographer who has created a sort of a way that he looks at the human face that's very tight, very close. He's done, this is his third piece for us that he's done. And when we thought about doing something in this issue, we wanted something that had that portrait feel. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at this, the changing demographics in the United States, and we thought, wow, that is so interesting. Let's take pictures of mixed race people. And also, it was so interesting when we started doing that, we would, you know, ask you, who are you, what are you, and what people, how people would self-identify themselves. And so it became like this beautiful, like you say, intimate portrait of these people and how they self-identify. I love that piece too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with National Geographic Photography Director Sarah Lean. Let's go on the phones now and speak with Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Oh, hey, Jim. Thanks. You know, my question is, you know, photography via cell phones, as you referred to, it's just exploded. And I've noticed over the just a very short time that people's photographs have just become much more stylized and really beautiful because the phone, the cameras have become much better quality and all. And I was just curious what's going to happen to actual journalism in that respect because a lot of people are just doing what I consider almost professional level photography with these phones.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to talk about that. The a lot of the incredible cell phone photography, you know, it's based on different apps people use that add sort of effects and take an image that might look a little bit ordinary and definitely stiff it up and make it look so much better. And you know, I like, there's certain apps I like too because they make my cell phone pictures look so much better. And I think we do see a lot of wonderful photography out there that people are using on their cell phones. But I think the difference is, and why I'm not worried about photojournalism, is a lot of people who out there, they're taking these pictures and they're getting lucky, I would say. Mm-hmm. They're making some nice images today, next week, you know, in the morning, the next day perhaps. But our photographers and photojournalists, they're doing it every day, all day long, and they're getting more than lucky, right? This is like, it's such a different thing to be working as a photojournalist on a story than it is, you know, me walking down the street taking pictures with my cell phone and making cool pictures. I think my pictures are really cool. But, you know, it's a very big difference in the type of thinking and work and process and reporting that goes on for a photojournalist than somebody who is, you know, an amateur and having a lot of fun and making some very cool frames.
I'm always amazed thinking about the patience that it takes to be an amazing photographer. You have to be sort of ready to go, ready to pounce at any moment, but maybe it'll take days. Or I think we talked to Paul Nicklin about waiting weeks and months for a photograph.
I think it's like baseball.
Mm-hmm.
You know how nothing happens for a really long time and then somebody hits
Boom.
It. Now, and the whole field gets busy,
yeah.
You know, and somebody's running from base to base. It's kind of like that. It's, you know, certain things, it's like ponderous and slow, and it takes a really long time. And so like the natural history photographers like Paul, you know, waiting for the animal to finally get up and stretch and yawn and do something. Or, you know, or people photographs where you're struggling to get access or something and make those pictures. But I think one of the things that we can offer here is that we give our photographers a lot of time on a story. We're able to do that so that they have the time. So if it doesn't work today, they can come back tomorrow. So we invest an awful lot in each story and giving the photographers the time they need. That's something that with every year you're asked to, you know, look at your budgets and figure out how to, you know, do things more streamlined. That's the one thing that we kind of jealously hang on to is the field time that we give the photographers.
Well, it's sort of a related question here via email from Earl in Dallas. Earl says, I'm curious to know if you have full-time staff or employees are contracted and are hired as needed.
We have most of the photographers who work for us are freelance. Back in the old days, they had a pretty robust staff of 25 or so full-time staff photographers. Now we have one staff photographer who works in our studio, and we have another one, Nick Nichols, who is a very premier natural history photographer. Everybody else is freelance, and we hire them on a story-by-story basis, whether we assign them or they bring the story to us, the idea to us. Sometimes we find a body of work that is complete or nearly complete, and we'll maybe pick that up whole and publish it.
How much contact are you able to have with your photographers when they're in the field? I guess satellite phones have made a lot of that easier than it used to be.
It depends, really, on where they're going. I remember when I was working as a photographer back in Siberia in the early 90s, there was nothing. You know, it was like I was sending telexes.
Really?
Husband.
So, literally.
I talked to him once in 2 months.
Wow.
On a phone. I found a phone that worked. But now, yes, with email and phone calls and sat phones and that kind of thing, it's much easier. But there are dark spots in the world, you know, where you don't get to, you can't stay in touch. But personally, as a photographer out there, I didn't really want to talk to the editor all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when you're out working as a photographer, that's when the story is yours.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like all yours, and you get to make the decision every day about whether to go left or go right. And it's kind of really fun to have that, because after that you have to start editing and sharing it, and the voices about what to do with it become more voices. So that time out there in the field is often, you know, very precious. So we have photographers who they go, they vanish, they never call. And then we have some that really like to be in touch, and they want to send you JPEGs and be in more conversation.
So you just got to kind of hold hands as necessary.
Exactly.
Sarah Lean is with us. She's director of photography at National Geographic magazine, which has just published its 125th anniversary edition. It's called The Photography Issue, and it's on newsstands now. If you'd like to join the conversation, send email to think@kera.org, call 1-800-933-5372, or send a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. National Geographic magazine turns 125 years old this year and has just published a special photography issue, which is on newsstands now. In honor of that, we're speaking with Sarah Lean, who is director of photography for National Geographic. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I have to say, I laughed when I saw the small article called Naked Truth that acknowledges the fact that, you know, children like under 13 the world over, if they know National Geographic.
Older than that sometimes.
Yeah. talk about the nudity. I mean, there hasn't been as much as people might imagine.
I know. 539 times, actually. When we were brainstorming, things for the front of the magazine, which is often smaller bits and lighter moments, we were often talking about how, this happened to me a lot too, you go out and you're working for National Geographic magazine, somebody says, oh, the first time I saw a naked woman was in National Geographic magazine, you know, and you're like, really? You know, and then it's sort of like we were talking about this and I said, I wonder how many times it's actually happened. Like, let's get to the bottom of this.
So did you call the intern, or how did that?
Yeah, some intern, somebody you know, who should get like a big cupcake, went through all the issues and counted them up, and it's 539 with one in this issue. So also, so it's kind of like that was like, and then the graphics people here thought, let's make a graph, you know. And it was like, okay, let's make a graph. So they made this pretty interesting graph. And it's, yeah, it's like it was very big in the early days, which is understandable because if you were exploring the world and cultures, there would be more cultures that were not closed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it had, and it's definitely diminished, you know, over the years. But we thought it was kind of a fun thing to just take this head on.
Well, and I'll just mention this, and then we'll move on from this topic. But in 1912, there were 20 in a single issue, and
a very big year.
Yeah, but then there were like 39. The longest gap ever came soon after that, with 39 issues that were nudity free.
I love that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Clark on the line in Weatherford. Hey, Clark.
Hi, Clark.
Hello. my first question is I learned to read by National Geographic when I was about 4 or 5 years old. My granny used to give me a National Geographic. She had them back to 1920s, something or other, and she'd say, look at the picture and tell me what you see. I'd tell her what I saw, and then she'd say, now read what's underneath it, read the caption.
Well, that's a really sweet story. And you know, what Clark referred to is his grandmother sort of saving these. I know of very few other magazines that, like, at least half the people that I grew up around had a stash of these in the basement that dated back for decades.
Absolutely. Me too. I had the same experience as the young girl in the summers in Minnesota, going in the basement and flipping through the magazines. And I didn't learn to read, but I learned about the world, and it made me want to go and see it. So it's a very common experience.
Now, I suppose it's a little bit different as people are preserving things more often in digital form, but is that part of the guiding principle that you think about a certain timelessness that you want every issue to have?
I think that, yeah, there's because we're not really a news magazine, you know, we, and also our sort of what you call lead time, like, which it would be the time when the story finishes before you can physically get it into the magazine,
right,
is months, not days or weeks. We look at stories in such a way that, you know, that they will kind of hold up over that time, and also that they're looking at the bigger picture, at the bigger causes, at the bigger things, not like daily events. And I think that, yeah, we definitely like to try to take a step back and take a big look and try to understand the entire subject in a larger way that has a longer lifespan than sort of just the news.
Tell us about the relationships between the photographers and the print writers who are working on the same pieces.
I think the writers and the photographers have various relationships depending on their personalities. Some photographers, you know, they just want to go out there and be by themselves. They don't want anybody. They don't want to work with, they don't want a writer along because they feel like there's different needs. Like the photographers want to photograph people doing things and writers want to talk to them. And so then they stop doing things to talk, right? Others are very much in partnership. They really like to work together. They request to work together. They sometimes propose stories together, and they're more like a team. And so we have different relationships. But so if a photographer and a writer are, say, working separately, they would still be in contact. Like, I went here, I saw this, you might want to check it out, or I talked to this person, he's got a great story. So there's a lot of crisscross and weaving so that even if they're not there at the same time or they're working sort of in parallel, we all end up in the same place with the same story. So it's very, very different person to person how people work.
And on the editing side, are the relationships similar when you are working with the print editor? And I would have to imagine that if, you know, if they were like a a battle of the wills, photography wins out at National Geographic?
Well, not always, but, you know, no, we try to share and be good and share space. It's in the magazine, it's more like space. It's all about pages,
right.
You know. Well, the story gets X number of pages, and then, you know, it's a little bit of a turf war sometimes on, you know, how much text. How many photographs, and it's also maps and graphics too. So we have to try to, you know, play nice and share. So there's that. But I think that's one of the great things about like the digital app or the internet. We can add more now.
Yeah.
You know, we can think about it as extending the way we publish, and even extending like the idea of what's a magazine. That the print magazine is just a step in the process now, and that we can maybe start publishing a little earlier, like the photographers are uploading something while they're on the road to Instagram, or now we've got a new blog called Proof, and they can make a blog post while they're out there. You know, or the writers can, you know, drop little notes earlier, well before the story publishes, so that we can sort of extend this dialogue and make a larger conversation about this topic, which I think will help a lot with that. It's not only just print, but print is just part of that larger storytelling process.
I'm so glad you brought up maps and graphs, Sarah, because those are sort of some of the unsung heroes sometimes of the magazine, and there are just really talented, creative people there at the magazine.
They are amazing. I mean, we've always been known for our great mapping, and I personally love maps, so I love a great map, and they make beautiful maps and all kinds of maps, you know, very detailed to very simple. Sometimes they're called on to just make the tiniest, simplest map, and it's just like a little jewel. And then the graphics people, you know, I don't understand them at all. They're like, they're amazing. You know, what they do and how they take all this data and visualize it is so incredible. And also, there's another step that they're doing now, you know, is animating them on the iPad or on the internet, on the website. So it's so cool, like some static thing in the magazine, and you can just watch this whole thing move and change and deliver this information in a whole other way. It's really incredible what they do. And thank you for mentioning them, because you're right, they're often the unsung heroes.
We have an email here from Joe in Fort Worth who wants to know what you think of HDR-style photography, which I'll confess I had to look up just now, and it stands for high dynamic range photography.
Yes, and, I don't like it so much if I can tell that that's what's happened.
Explain what it is.
Well, this is, you probably just read about it, so you might be able to explain it better than me, but it's a process where you can take like multiple images. So back when we were shooting film with what they would call latitude, like the sort of distance between a highlight and a shadow, kind of narrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so digital, it's expanded that range. So you can shoot in the dark and still get, you know, a lot of information out of all those pixels. But it's even in some cases you want even more, so you can make a image that's for the highlight, for the middle, for the next part, for the shadow, and then you can combine them then, and you can expand that range of detail, which could be really cool, but sometimes it goes too far, and I think they look very illustrated, like an illustration or a drawing, you know, and so I'm not so keen on it when I can tell. You know, I don't want to see technique. It's like I often say to the photographers, I don't want to be thinking about the lens you use when you shot the picture. I just want to be looking at what's happening in the picture. Like, I don't want all the technique to show up and be in my face.
That's interesting for you to say, because I'm sure you almost can't help but be aware of that. But you want, as a human viewer, you want to be have that awareness suspended.
Yeah, I like looking at it, and I don't want to think, oh, this wide-angle lens, there's so much distortion, you know, on the edges or something, you know. I find that to be taking me away from the message and the content that's in the image. And I think that's the same with some of these digital techniques, you know. They become about that technique.
Yeah. We have an email here from John who writes, in recent social media, there is one picture described as the most important ever published. It's a picture National Geographic published about the Hubble telescope. and shows a picture of thousands of galaxies in deep space. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, we published it, but obviously we didn't take it.
Right.
The Hubble took the picture. Astronomy, archaeology, the sciences, they're very important to the mix of stories we do. We have a lot of people who are very much fans of that kind of photography. It's all part of, you know, when you think about the geographic exploring, you know, space is something that is being explored and that we're constantly doing stories about different space exploration. And I think those Hubble pictures are magical and beautiful. They look like amazing landscapes in the night sky.
I like them because they don't even look real, which is funny. It's a funny reason to like them.
Yes. Well, I think things that don't look real but are real are magical.
Yeah. So you can apply a set of rules to choose images, and I'm sure these are helpful at a basic level, right? You want, you know, the exposure to be correct, the color to be a certain way, you want a certain level of clarity. Is there also something about the right pictures that you find impossible to describe, which may be an impossible question to answer, but...
Well, I think, I don't have a lot of rules. I mean, truthful is a big rule, but in terms of, you know, and not unfalse, you know, but I... Sometimes blurry is great.
Mm.
Blurry is beautiful. Blurry is evocative. I think I want to feel something when I look at a photograph. I want to feel happy or sad, angry, outraged. I want to be moved. I want to care. You know, I want the picture to come in my eyes and I want it to grab hold of my heart. That's what I want. It's not so much the technical or that kind of thing. It's how do I feel when I look at a picture. When I'm talking to the photographers that I work with and I'm editing their work, you know, sometimes you see them struggling with something. You know, you see in the images they're taking, they're trying so hard to make a picture out of this thing and it's just not working and everything. And I talk to them, I say, listen, if you're standing in front of something and you're photographing it, and you're bored because it's so hard and it's not working, well, I'm looking at the picture being bored too.
Hmm.
And I don't want to be bored.
Yeah.
I want to be like my mouth watering, you know, and I think that's what I'm looking for.
Did it take you a while, Sarah, to learn to deal with this? I mean, I imagine that your job is really emotional on a regular basis.
It is. It can be, you know. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of personalities. These people are special. They're hanging it all out there. You know, they're missing their kids' birthdays. They're getting malaria. They're in car wrecks. They're eating crackers. They're not getting any sleep. You know, so it's like that. There's that aspect of taking care of people and encouraging them. There's also just inside the building. There's always things going on, like any place, any
right.
office. You know, okay, now we're going to do this, and let's change that. And, you know, so it's pretty exciting. There's a lot of levels.
Sarah Lean is director of photography at National Geographic magazine. A special 125th anniversary edition called The Photography Issue is on newsstands now. Sarah, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.